I'd like to begin today by reading four quick references from Scripture that give us really a clear picture of God's perspective on the topic that we'll continue today. First of all, Proverbs chapter 6, verses 16 through 19. You can jot these down if you'd like. We're going to just simply read them and reference them, so I don't know if you'll be able to turn there quickly enough, but you're welcome to if you can. Proverbs 6, verses 16 through 19. Which says, these six things the Lord hates. Yes, seven are an abomination to him. And that list there of six things that God hates, seven that are an abomination to him, include a lying tongue and a false witness who speaks lies. The next reference is in Revelation 21, verse 8. Revelation 21, verse 8, which says, but the cowardly, unbelieving, abominable, murderers, sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars shall have their parts in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. Just a chapter later in Revelation 22, verses 14 and 15, record for us, blessed are those who do his commandments, that they may have the right to the tree of life, and may enter through the gates into the city, referring to the New Jerusalem. But outside are dogs and sorcerers and sexually immoral and murderers and idolaters and whoever loves and practices a lie. And the fourth final reference that we'll cover at the beginning here of the message is in Proverbs chapter 12, verse 22. Proverbs 12, verse 22, which leaves us with a bit more hope than maybe these first three references about God hating these actions, these practices, these lifestyles. While it includes God's perspective on the topic, it also gives us hope, brethren. Proverbs 12, verse 22, which says, lying lips are an abomination to the Lord, but those who deal truthfully are his delight. Those who deal truthfully are his delight. Yes, God hates lying. Those who love and practice a lie, who make this a part of their normal lifestyle, including lying and bearing false witness as just part of their normal approach to life, will not inherit the kingdom of God. They'll be destroyed in the second death. But that's really for their good and for the good of others. God does not sentence people to the lake of fire because he takes some pleasure in catching human beings in their failure, that he's just looking for us to slip up so he can throw someone else in those flames. That is the fate, the second death is the fate only of those for whom it is actually most merciful to end their lives forever. God knows the damage and the pain that sin causes to us and to others around us, and he will not allow any human being to live forever who sets on a perpetual pattern of harming themselves and others with sin. So actually, the second death is merciful. Merciful to the person who continues to persist in hurting themselves with a sinful lifestyle, and merciful to everyone else around them as well. So yes, lying lips are an abomination to God. He hates this practice, but only because he loves us. He wants what's best for us. Those who deal truthfully are his delight, because he also knows what that approach to life will yield. An approach of dealing truthfully will yield loving relationships built on trust and integrity that can achieve the true unity God desires for us. Our lives as Christians, with the help of God's Spirit, are really a process of learning to abhor what's evil and to love what's good. It's a lifelong process of learning to trust that God knows best, that he knows what's best for us. A lifelong process of allowing his way of thinking to become our own. But if we're to learn to think how he thinks, if we're to learn how to deal truthfully so that we can be God's delight, we have to recognize where the love and practice of lies can manifest itself. As we covered last time, Satan, the father of lies, is going to work wherever he can to try to get us to accept the practice of lying, to try to justify it and make it part of our pattern. He's not only going to work in the obvious, blatant forms of false witness, but in some more subtle ways as well. So my point today, brethren, is that false witness comes in many different forms, all of which we need to be aware of so that we can recognize and remove those forms of false witness from our lives and instead deal truthfully and become God's delight. That is what he has in mind for us. That is a future we can't achieve with God's help. The types of false witness that we'll review today could really be placed in a long line, a continuum from, on the one end, the most egregious, appalling forms of lying, to at the other end of the spectrum or this continuum, those forms of false witness that are pretty socially accepted, considered normal, maybe even viewed as necessary. But as always, our measure of right and wrong is not defined by the social norms of the world around us. We have to use God's word as the standard for clarity. We want to be aware of all of these forms of false witness, from the ones that are egregious and obvious to the ones that might be more subtle and Satan can use to get us involved in the practice of lying. We could divide these forms of false witness into two broad categories, as we will today. Outright lies and half-truths. Outright lies, things that people know are not true when they state it. And in the other category, half-truths. We're going to alternate between these categories as we progress through the message today and cover several different examples of outright lies and half-truths that Satan can use, that we can get caught up in and become enraptured in this process of practicing a lie. If we don't stand against it, if we don't increase our awareness, recognize it, and remove it from our lives. So let's jump right in. Outright lie number one, or type of outright lie number one, slander. Slander. Slander can be defined as the deliberate invention of a lie to injure a neighbor. The deliberate invention of a lie to injure a neighbor. In modern terms, slander is a form of defamation of character that includes the damage of someone's reputation using false statements. And in our modern society, defamation of character involves a verbal statement. Then there's something else in our world today called libel, which basically is slander in written form, defaming someone else's character in what we write. In simple terms, slander is lying about someone else to try to hurt them, to try to hurt their reputation. And you know, that fits ever so perfectly with the breakdown of the words that make up the ninth commandment that we covered last time. Remember, it was just those five words. No speak false witness neighbor, in a nutshell. Slander is one of the most obvious forms of violating that command. You're purposely speaking something false to harm your neighbor and their reputation. Let's turn to 1 Kings chapter 21 for an example of this here. 1 Kings 21. With each of these examples of false witness today, there are many different stories, accounts recorded for us in Scripture that we could turn to. So I tried to practice a little self-control and trim it down, but there are many other examples you can think of and tie into each of these types of lying, false witness. 1 Kings 21 is a pretty clear and obvious example I think we can turn to. The context here in 1 Kings 21 is King Ahab has gone to Naboth and asked him to sell him his vineyard. I'll buy it from you for money, or if you'd prefer, I'll trade another vineyard for yours. And Naboth said, no, this is my family inheritance. I'm not going to sell it to you. And we find Naboth, the end of verse 4, basically pouting like a little kid. He won't give me his vineyard. We'll pick it up in verse 5. But Jezebel, his wife, came to him and said to him, why is your spirit so sullen that you eat no food? He said to her, because I spoke to Naboth, the Jezreelite, and said to him, give me your vineyard for money, or else if it pleases you, I'll give you another vineyard for it. And he answered, I will not give you my vineyard. Then Jezebel, his wife, said to him, you now exercise authority over Israel. Arise, eat food. Let your heart be cheerful. I'll give you the vineyard of Naboth, the Jezreelite. And she wrote letters in Ahab's name, sealed them with his seal, and sent the letters to the elders and the nobles who were dwelling in the city with Naboth. She wrote in the letters saying, proclaim a fast, and seat Naboth with high honor among the people, and seat two men scoundrels before him to bear witness against him, saying, "You have blasphemed God and the king." Then take him out and stone him that he may die. If you continue reading the account here, that's exactly what happened. These scoundrels, these false witnesses, spoke things against Naboth, saying he blasphemed God and the king, things that were completely untrue, things that were just made up about Naboth so that he would be killed. And then Jezebel could say, "Oh, okay, this vineyard's available now. Let me get it for my husband Ahab." Now, this is a clear example of slander in action. Jezebel openly hires false witnesses to just go and make something up that's untrue to try to cause harm to another individual. They slandered Naboth and had him killed when really the only thing that he did was to refuse to sell off his family inheritance. There was nothing wrong that he had done as he was accused of. This is an outright lie in the form of slander. King David records for us how he felt about these types of lies, and I believe in a sense we have recorded for us how God feels about slander as well. Psalm 101. Psalm 101, we'll begin in verse 5. And read David's words here. Psalm 101, beginning in verse 5, David writes, "Whoever secretly slanders his neighbor, him I will destroy. The one who has a haughty look and a proud heart, him I will not endure. My eyes shall be on the faithful of the land, that they may dwell with me. He who walks in a perfect way, he shall serve me. He who works deceit shall not dwell within my house. He who tells lies shall not continue in my presence." And we could read this from David's perspective as the psalmist and understand why he would say what he said. You know, he didn't want anyone dwelling in his house that was going to be a deceitful person. He didn't want them in his presence because, as we discussed last time, there's an effect on trust when someone lies. And he speaks specifically to slander. "He who secretly slanders his neighbor, him I will destroy." But I think we can read the words of this psalm from God's perspective as well. That these would be words God himself could say, if that's not actually what's happening here. That whoever secretly slanders his neighbor, whoever's in the practice of that kind of approach, him I will destroy. He who loves and practices a lie, he will be part of the second death. He's not going to dwell in my house, he who works deceit. He's not going to be in my presence. So slander is one of the most blatant forms of deceit. We can easily see how it damages others and it destroys trust along the way as well. But there are other forms of false witness that are much more subtle. So half-truth number one. Let's go over to the other category. Half-truth number one, tale-bearing. Tale-bearing. Not a term we use often, but it'll probably sound familiar to you because I just talked about it in relation to the eighth commandment not too long ago. We talked about its connection there from the perspective of breaking confidentiality with someone, sharing the news about something in the life of another individual, whether it's good or bad, without permission, sharing something that's not really ours. Stealing someone's thunder is the approach we took when we were talking there about tale-bearing. But I think there's a connection here to another form of tale-bearing that is connected to violating the ninth commandment as well. If you go with me back to Leviticus 19. Leviticus 19. Let's read verse 16, Leviticus 19, verse 16, which says, "You shall not go about as a talebearer among your people, nor shall you take a stand against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord, the Eternal." Very clear instruction here, don't do this. But I think reading it within the context of the surrounding verses will help us to glean even more about what's being talked about here, what this tale-bearing involves. Let's go back to verse 15. Leviticus 19, verse 15. "You shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor honor the person of the mighty. In righteousness you shall judge your neighbor. You shall not go about as a talebearer among your people, nor shall you take a stand against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. You shall not hate your brother in your hearts. You shall surely rebuke your neighbor and not bear sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the children of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. I think it's helpful to read verse 16 in the context of these surrounding verses, because we see then that in a passage about justice and judgment, about not hating your brother, not taking vengeance against someone, not bearing a grudge, that's when we read this instruction, you shall not go about as a talebearer among your people, nor shall you take a stand against the life of your neighbor. Based on this context, it seems to me that the type of talebearing being addressed here is, first of all, the term talebearing means bearing, carrying a tale, passing on a story. This type of talebearing addressed is bearing a tale, passing on a story for the purpose of affecting the judgment of others or taking a direct stand against someone else. Someone you hate, someone you have a grudge against, someone you want to see vengeance executed on. Talebearing can be defined as spreading of evil reports, carrying stories to our neighbor's discredit. When you consider this type of gossip, because that's in a sense the simple modern term that's associated with talebearing, it often involves only half-truths. Yep, it can come in the form of slander, things that are just completely made up, a tall tale someone tells about you or about someone else. But often, this talebearing involves half-truths. If a tale is spread for the purpose of damaging someone else's reputation, out of hatred or vengeance or because of a grudge, it's likely only going to include the parts of the story that paint the disliked person in a negative light. Right? This form of talebearing, I could say, is a cousin to slander, but I think it's more like a half-sister. There's a closer connection there. Both are done for the purpose of damaging the reputation of someone else. The difference is slander involves spreading outright lies, something that's not true, whereas talebearing can include true stories or information, but with selective details that fit the agenda of the storyteller. The danger of talebearing is that since there is some truth in what's communicated, it can be easy for the hearer to get caught up in spreading this half-truth without really seeing any problem with it. I'm just telling people what happened. I'm just telling the facts. It's easy to find ourselves entangled in this form of false witness, easier than it is to get entangled in something like slander, stuff that's obviously made up, especially if there's some hurt of the past involved. If there are hurt feelings from a past interaction or grudges or a desire for vengeance present, it's easy for us to get caught up in this type of talebearing, passing on half-truths, but only the negative parts. But do we become witnesses putting our stamp of approval on the information we're passing on, even when we repeat these kinds of matters? We can be false witnesses by purposely only including half of the truth, but we can also become kind of a link in the chain of false witness by just sharing the half-truths that we learn from others with someone else. Either way, we don't want to be part of that chain of false witnesses. It's important we check ourselves for this type of behavior, passing on tales only to support our own negative estimation of someone's character. And it's equally important that we be careful about becoming a link in that chain of false witnesses, sharing only partial truths about events or about people that don't provide a fair, balanced picture of the whole situation. So this first half-truth, talebearing, it involves an intent to deceive, just like slander. They both involve deceit for the purpose of harming the reputation of someone else. But let's move on to some other forms of false witness that have a different motivation in mind. Outright lie number two. Outright lie number two. Lying for personal gain. Now, the first two we talked about, lying to damage someone else, but now lying for personal gain and using outright blatant lies to do so. There are many examples of this that we can think of in Scripture. I'm just going to reference a few of them. First of all, the story of Jacob and Esau. When Jacob lied to his father about being Esau, he goes before his father and he says, "Hey, it's your son Esau, bless me." And where did he get this idea? From his mother, who said, "Hey, go in and deceive your father, tell him you're Esau, and get the blessing." A blatant lie, yet there was some personal gain that was desired, this special blessing from Isaac. We see here that it's an outright lie for the purpose of personal gain. Another example would be the story of Elisha's servant Gehazi. You might not be as familiar with this one, but in 2 Kings chapter 5, 2 Kings chapter 5, we'll just paraphrase the story there. It's the story of when Naaman the Syrian is healed of his leprosy. And after Naaman was healed of his leprosy, Elisha refused to accept a gift for his role in this healing. Naaman offers, you know, "What can I give you as a reward for what you've done for me?" And Elisha refused to accept a gift. He sent him away. He said, "Nope, I'm not going to take anything from your hand." Well, Elisha's servant Gehazi hears this and he lets greed begin to creep in. And he follows after Naaman after he departs. And he chases him down and he says, "Oh, right after you left, a couple of sons of the prophets came along. And you know what? My master, Elisha, he changed his mind. He sent me over to get a talent of silver and a couple changes of clothing." And Naaman said, "Please take 2 talents of silver and take these 2 changes of clothing." Gehazi lied because he wanted stuff. He wanted money. He wanted the clothing. He wanted material goods. It was an outright blatant lie for personal gain. He wanted these material goods, and instead what he got at the end of the story was Naaman's leprosy. Elisha said, "Because you've done this, now let the leprosy of Naaman be upon you and upon your household." And he lived with leprosy for the rest of his life. So these are 2 clear examples of lying for personal gain. But sometimes the personal gain that someone desires isn't something so tangible and concrete. It's not goods or money, finances. There can be a different type of personal gain involved. As in the story we find in Acts chapter 5. Let's go ahead and turn to this one. Acts 5, beginning in verse 1. Acts chapter 5, verse 1. This is right on the heels of a section we read recently about Barnabas, the son of encouragement. The end of chapter 4, Barnabas had sold a piece of land he had and used the proceeds to help provide for those who were staying in Jerusalem to kind of figure out, what do we do from here? Right after that, Acts chapter 5, verse 1, it says, "But a certain man named Ananias, with Sapphira his wife, sold a possession. And he kept back part of the proceeds, his wife also being aware of it, and brought a certain part and laid it at the apostles' feet. But Peter said, 'Ananias, why has Satan filled your heart to lie to the Holy Spirit and keep back part of the price of the land for yourself? While it remained, was it not your own? And after it was sold, was it not in your own control? Why have you conceived this thing in your hearts? You've not lied to men, but to God. You're trying to present yourself as having more character than you actually have. As if you can trick the one that actually makes a difference to, the one who knows the hearts of men and knows our true character.' And the young men arose," verse 5, "Then Ananias, hearing these words, fell down and breathed his last. So great fear came upon all those who heard these things." He dropped dead. If you drop down a couple verses later, 3 hours later, his wife comes in. Peter gives her a chance to be honest, says, "Tell us whether you sold the land for so much or not." And she said, "Yes, for so much." In verse 9, Peter said to her, "How is it that you have agreed together to test the Spirit of the Lord? Look, the feet of those who have buried your husband are at the door, and they will carry you out." Then immediately she fell down at his feet and breathed her last. And the young men came in, carried her out, buried her next to her husband. Now, what was going on here in this story? Peter even asks Ananias, was it not yours to sell? This wasn't a requirement put on the people in the church in Jerusalem at that time. They didn't have to go sell off their possessions. He did this of his own free will. Neither was it a requirement that if he did choose to sell this possession, that he had to give all of the proceeds towards supporting other people. None of that was required. Yet he and his wife tried to present it as if that's what was happening. We are so generous that we're selling off this land we have and we're giving every dime of it to help support the people. What was the personal gain they were seeking from this lie? It wasn't something concrete and tangible. It was praise of others. They wanted to be thought well of by other people. Now, these are just a few examples in Scripture of many about lying for personal gain. But the lesson we see here from just reviewing a few of these, is we see that personal gain can be sought by lying, but personal gain can be sought for tangible, concrete things, but it can also be the gain of abstract things like respect or praise or sympathy or honor that people desire from their lies as well. Just wanting to be thought of highly by others. And that's not just limited to biblical accounts, as we all know. We see examples of both targets of personal gain in the news all the time. I mean, day after day, we see headlines about people in court because of fraudulent actions, trying to take advantage of other people, whether it's cryptocurrency or whether it's, you know, one of the most recent things in the headlines is former President Trump being penalized $354 million for financial fraud, being found guilty of lying about his net worth to take advantage of lenders. That's a desire for personal gain, financial in this case. But then we see the other side of it in headlines as well. A couple years back, one of the big stories in the news was about an actor named Jesse Smollett, who was convicted on charges related to lying to the police. He lied to police about being the victim of a hate crime that involved assault that was said to be motivated by racism and homophobia. Well, the court later found that he had staged the whole incident, that he had set up this whole assault scene. Why? There's no tangible personal financial material gain that would come from this. Was it a desire to further his career, get his name out there, become more well known? Was it to garner sympathy? Was it to promote a cause? Who knows exactly, but it was an example in modern day of lying for personal gain that's a little more abstract. Brethren, we're all susceptible to the same tendency to be tempted to lie when it might benefit us or make life easier. Whether it might benefit us tangibly, financially, or whether it might just make us look better. What do we do in those moments? Are we people who deal truthfully so that God delights in us? Does our integrity remain intact when those temptations come? Outright lying can be for personal gain, whether concrete or abstract, but half-truths can be used for the same purpose. Half-truth number two, spin. Spin. Spin is presenting facts in a way that puts you or your purpose in the best light rather than in a way that gives the clearest picture of the full reality of everything that's really going on here. In other words, truth is used to accomplish someone's agenda. But it's a half-truth. It's a limited amount of truth, a partial truth from a certain perspective or from a certain angle. I want to read a section from one of our blogs on Life, Hope, and Truth. This is from a series written by Eddie Foster. It's an outstanding series titled The Enemies of Honesty. Enemies of Honesty, and there are three separate blog posts that are part of this series. This one is Enemies of Honesty, Spin. It begins, "The word spin originated from the old idiom to spin a yarn, which means to tell a tall tale or exaggerated story. in the 1980s, it was infused with a more political meaning involving people who did this kind of storytelling about their employers. It was telling information from a certain perspective rather than objectively. Therefore, the Merriam-Webster Dictionary now has this definition for spin doctor. A spin doctor, a person such as a political aide, responsible for ensuring that others interpret an event from a particular point of view. So spin is telling the truth from a certain point of view. Unfortunately, that certain point of view is in fact an enemy of honesty. There's nothing wrong with staying positive, looking on the bright side, but not at the expense of reality. Honesty is objective and balanced, while spin is more about deceptively making something look more favorable or less favorable than it actually is. I'll end the quote there. It's involving truth, using truth, but again, for the purpose of deceiving others, getting them to look at things from your perspective, see things your way, agree with you. Let's go back to Genesis 20 for an example. Genesis chapter 20, beginning in verse 1. We have a clear example here of a half-truth utilized. Genesis 20, beginning in verse 1. And Abraham journeyed from there to the south and dwelt between Kadesh and Shur and stayed in Gerar. Now Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, "She is my sister." And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. But God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, "Indeed, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is a man's wife." But Abimelech had not come near her, and he said, "Lord, will you slay a righteous nation also? Did he not say to me, 'She is my sister'? And she, even she herself, said, 'He is my brother.' In the integrity of my heart and innocence of my hands, I have done this." And God goes on to respond and say, "I realize that. And if you do the right thing, you don't have to worry about an ongoing punishment here. But if you do something inappropriate, watch out." We pick it up in verse 9. And Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, "What have you done to us? How have I offended you that you have brought on me and on my kingdom a great sin? You have done deeds to me that ought not to be done." Then Abimelech said to Abraham, "What did you have in view that you have done this thing? What's your angle here, Abraham?" And Abraham said, "Because I thought, surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they will kill me on account of my wife. But indeed, she is truly my sister. She's the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife." He's utilizing a half-truth here for his personal gain. In this situation, this desire to try to keep himself safe and to keep Sarah safe, I guess, was the intent, although he did this twice now, where Abraham's spin of the truth, his providing only a half-truth, "She's my sister," actually led to his wife having to live in a king's harem twice, because he did the exact same thing back in Genesis chapter 12 with the Pharaoh of Egypt. He thinks he's trying to protect himself and his wife, and he puts his wife in this situation of having to live with this other man who's interested in her and thinks she's available. Twice. Abimelech basically asks here, "What's your angle, Abraham?" And Abraham's justification is, "Well, it's technically true. She is my sister." I think that brings out an important point for us, brethren. It is possible to use the truth to deceive. It is possible to use the truth to deceive. That's what Abraham was doing here. He only revealed half of the truth, the part of the truth, the perspective on the facts that he thought would benefit him most. While in reality, this spin caused a whole lot of trouble. And it caused Sarah to be shamed at the end of the chapter here, too. When you read what Abimelech said to her, these are pretty strong words. She's put in her place for her role in this deceit. Of course, the original spin doctor is Satan himself. If you think back to the accounts in Genesis 3 in the Garden of Eden, his interaction with Eve, it's all a bunch of half-truths. spun from a limited perspective. He said to Eve, "Has God indeed said, 'You shall not eat of every tree of the garden?'" Now, he's trying to get her to look at things from a specific perspective. He doesn't say, "Oh, did God tell you you can't eat of that one tree out of all these?" No, he's putting the focus on God's limiting you. Eve responds and says, "Of all the trees we can eat except this one, if we eat of that one, we'll die." Satan responds by saying, "You will not surely die." It's a lie, but in a sense, it's a half-truth. When Eve took that bite of the fruit, she probably thought, "Oh, the serpent's right. I'm still alive. I didn't just drop dead instantly. Maybe God wasn't being honest with me." But it was absolutely true that she would die because now she had earned the eternal death penalty of sin. Half-truth, spun for the purpose of getting her to look at things from a particular perspective. And then Satan goes on to say, "For God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you'll be like God, knowing good and evil." Well, it's true, their eyes would be opened once they ate of this fruit. Something would change. They would have the ability to know good and evil, but that term knowing good and evil really has the idea of determining good and evil, deciding for yourself. They wouldn't have the perfect knowledge of God and truly know what was good for them and what wasn't. Satan used spin. He basically told her enough of the truth to hook her and left out enough of the lie to make it seem like a win-win. Do we want a modern example of spin? Just watch news coverage of any polarized topic on two different news networks that lean toward opposite sides of the political aisle. You'll see many examples of spin. The same stats can be used, the same set of facts, with a much different angle or much different conclusions that are drawn based on the same information. That's spin. And actually, brethren, this is a good practice for us to be in, to consider coverage of some of these topics from opposing viewpoints, because the truth usually lies somewhere in the middle and not always clearly on one end of the spectrum. There's spin involved. And this is a good practice, especially because, as Eddie Foster points out in the Life, Hope, and Truth blog here, highlighting one point of view is spin's specialty. Highlighting just one point of view is spin's specialty. So we can't just accept the first thing we hear, one limited perspective, as accurate. But it's not just the news media that utilizes spin. I mean, consider modern courtrooms. Isn't an attorney's whole job to use the same set of facts and information, but to spin it in a way that gets people to look at things from their point of view, a unique angle? That's their full-time job. But it's not just in the courtrooms, in the media. The tendency to get caught up in spin is something that affects people like you and me too. Because if we're honest with ourselves, people often tell stories about themselves in such a way as to avoid the negative and only highlight the positive. Spin for the purpose of personal gain, right? We want other people to think well of us. Proverbs 18, verse 17 says, "The first one to plead his cause seems right until his neighbor comes and examines him." Often, when there's an interpersonal conflict, whether that's in a family or a workplace or even in a congregation, the story usually begins with a detailed description of how I, whoever that I is, whoever the person is telling the story, how I was putting so much effort into being kind in my approach, patient and caring as I spoke to this other person. I was trying my best to really follow the example of Jesus Christ. But then he or she, and then they go on with a description that paints the other individual as if they could be a candidate for the next lab-made creature that could be part of Jurassic Park 37 or whichever number they're on right now. Right? We tell the story to make ourselves look and sound good, pointing out all the highlights of the good things we did, leaving out those parts that might make people think a little less of us. The way we convey stories, especially about challenging conflicts with other people, is definitely a common opportunity to get caught up in using spin in our lives. It's not always a half-truth for the damage of someone else, as with tale-bearing, but it might be a half-truth for personal gain, to try to further our personal agenda, uphold our reputation, get others to agree with us and be on our side, etc. One of these Life, Hope, and Truth articles, I believe it was the one written by Dave Myers, has this short but powerful quote: "The problem with half-truths is that they're also half-lies." The problem with half-truths is that they're also half-lies. If the intent is to deceive by limiting the perspective on the facts, then spin is serving as a false witness. And if we step back and think about the message last week, the spirit of the law here, why this is so important not to get caught up in this type of practice, it damages trust. When the limiting of the facts eventually comes to light and people find out, okay, you were only telling me the details that you wanted me to know about that made you look good, that damages trust. It damages unity. One more quote from Eddie Foster on this blog about spin. He says, "It might seem like a paradox, but it is possible to use the truth to deceive. We must strive to make sure our expressions of truth have no ulterior motives or hidden agendas." And he goes on a little later to say, "We can ask ourselves questions such as, did I just tell the whole story or just the parts that made me look good? Did I just use the truth in a deceitful way, or did I make sure that my words had no hidden agenda or ulterior motive?" We need to honestly examine the whys and hows of what we say. So let's move on from there. Outright lie number 3, denial. Outright lie number 3, denial, or we could label this one as reactionary lying. Reactionary lying. This form of false witness can include, again, a desire for personal gain, but I think even more often it involves lying simply for self-preservation, as a reaction in the moment, lying to avoid hurt or punishment or having others think less of you. It has connections to lying for personal gain or to spin, but the difference is that it is reactionary in nature rather than premeditated. Two quick examples of this. First of all, in Genesis 18. Genesis 18, verse 9. Just prior to the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, we have these three men that appear to Abraham, and they're talking with him. As we examine the context, it becomes obvious that one of these three men was none other than the Word, whom we know as Jesus Christ, who is interacting with Abraham personally here. Genesis 18 and verse 9, and he says, "Then they said to him, where is Sarah, your wife? So he said, here in the tent. And he said," referring to the Word, "I will certainly return to you according to the time of life. And behold, Sarah, your wife, shall have a son." Sarah was listening in the tent door, which was behind them. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, well advanced in age, and Sarah had passed the age of childbearing. Therefore, Sarah laughed within herself, saying, "After I have grown old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also?" And the Lord said to Abraham, "Why did Sarah laugh, saying, shall I surely bear a child since I am old? Is anything too hard for the Lord, the Eternal? At the appointed time, I will return to you according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son." And then verse 15, "But Sarah denied it, saying, I did not laugh, for she was afraid. And he said, no, but you did laugh." It's interesting. I think it's one of the proofs here that this was God interacting with them, that it says Sarah laughed within herself. And yet he knew what had happened in her heart and mind. And he says, no, you can't pull the wool over my eyes. You did laugh. I know what took place. We're not given all the details here behind Sarah's laugh. You know, was it a laugh of cynicism? Like, huh, yeah, right. Or was it a laugh springing from a lack of faith? If it was, she grew in faith, because Hebrews 11 says, by faith she gained strength to conceive. Or was Sarah just a very visual thinker, like my wife happens to be? And as soon as she heard this, she just kind of laughed within herself, because she began instantly picturing the scene of her 90-year-old self with a cane in one hand and a nursing infant in the other. We're not told exactly, but she seems to recognize that her laughter, even though it was within herself, could come across in an inappropriate or unappreciative way. And her reaction is to deny it. I didn't laugh. People can get away with a lot of lies, but you can't pull one over on God. She likely reacted quickly, perhaps thinking, I don't want God to get upset with me and change his mind. I mean, it does say she was afraid. That's why she denied it. We know God isn't so easily offended that he would have removed that blessing from her. Yet her reaction was to deny something she knew was false. She knew she really laughed, but yet there's this knee-jerk reaction in us carnally to sometimes lie out of self-preservation. It's interesting. Abraham's reaction a chapter before was the same. Not only a laugh within himself. If you look at Genesis 17, verse 16, God tells him, I will bless her and also give you a son by her. I will bless her and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of peoples shall be from her. And in Genesis 17, verse 17, then Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said in his heart, shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? And shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child? His reaction was to belly laugh and roll on the floor. But Sarah's was within her heart, and still she had this knee-jerk reaction to deny that she had done that and lie about it. We, too, can have those kinds of reactions at times if we're not cognizant of guarding against that. We can respond in a way that doesn't even make sense in the moment, because afterwards we realize, that wasn't true. Why did I say that? Kids do it all the time. You know, with frosting and chocolate crumbs all over their mouth, and they say, I didn't eat cake. I don't know where the cake went, but it's not in here. Athletes do it all the time. In a competitive setting where there's this desire for self-preservation, I don't want to be the one to make a mistake and ruin it for the team, so they can vehemently deny that the ball landed inbounds on their side of the court, or that they dropped a pass, or that they committed a foul or a penalty. Grown men can stand up and say, what? I didn't touch him. I didn't do that. And then they play back the replay, and it's like, oh, yeah, I guess I did. We, likewise, whether it's a large or a small matter, can respond dishonestly at times as a reaction to try to save face or avoid a consequence or keep someone from thinking poorly of us. But really, the opposite of that is usually the effect. People do think poorly of us. Our character comes into question. Trust is affected whenever we lie. Something we should be on guard against. We can just refer to another example in the New Testament. During the last day of Jesus Christ's life, exactly what he told Peter would happen came to pass. He told Peter, you're going to deny me 3 times. And Peter did. Now, I think we need to put ourselves in Peter's shoes for a minute and realize what he was witnessing. We can understand why this desire for self-preservation kicked in. He was watching his friend, the one he believed to be the Messiah, being beaten, you know, coming out with a crown of thorns on his head, blood probably running down his face. And people are saying, hey, you're his friend, aren't you? You're a disciple of his. And Peter's reaction is to deny it and say, I don't know him. No, I'm not his disciple. You've got the wrong guy. To the extent that in Mark 14, verse 71, this final of the three denials, Mark 14, 71 says, then he began to curse and swear, I do not know this man of whom you speak. It was a passionate, vehement denial, something that Peter knew simply wasn't true. It's almost as if the more we tell a lie, the more we can start to believe it ourselves or feel like we have to stand upon that lie and not give in. There's this power of self-preservation when it's apart from a reliance on God for strength that can kick in if we don't guard against it. So we can guard against this reactive form of false witness. Pray ahead of time that God will give us the strength and the courage to be honest, even when it's hard. And while denial is an outright lie about something that we know is not true, that's not necessarily the case for the next half-truth. Half-truth number three, misinformation. Misinformation. Spreading false or inaccurate information can obviously happen knowingly. We can do that on purpose. But I think that would make it a blatant lie that falls into one of the categories we already covered, either to damage someone else or for personal gain. But spreading misinformation can also happen unknowingly. It can happen rather easily when there's some truth to the material that we hear and we think it's right. But what I want to convey in this particular point is the importance and responsibility we have in doing our due diligence to make sure that what we pass on is indeed true. There is so much misinformation available in the world today. It wasn't all that long ago that the term fact check would have been unfamiliar to us. Now it's common because the prevalence of polarized opinions, false reports that are presented as dogmatic fact, you know, the prevalence of these deep fake videos where you think something's actually happened that never actually occurred, it was manufactured. We've had examples in the news in recent years of people writing an article describing a war or a conflict happening, and then they find out later the pictures were from a war 20 years ago. Misinformation is prevalent. And the ability of just about anyone to share information online as if it is fact instantly is prevalent. There's also a growing trend among people of becoming instant experts on any given topic of choice, often after they've read about 2.5 articles on the subject. Or because they saw a headline or a pithy meme that seemed to really simplify the topic, so then they think they know the real truth about this. Now, some of that misinformation is the result of being fed tale-bearing or spin, made of half-truths. Some of it may come from misinformation that we heard or read and really thought was true at the time. That's what's different about this form of false witness. There's not necessarily an intent to deceive. When we share misinformation, we might think we're passing something on that is really helpful and accurate. But that's where this kind of continuum of bearing false witness comes in. Some things that are egregious and appalling and obviously a violation of the Ninth Commandment, and others that we have to consider. Is this a form of false witness? Even if we're pretty innocent and harmless in the act of deceit, even when we unknowingly pass on information, have we not filled the role of a false witness if we pass something on that is not true? If we put our stamp of approval on something as accurate that we or someone else later discovers is not true, that affects our credibility. It affects the trust people have in us. It affects their trust of the information we pass on about other things in the future. I'm not saying that telling others about something that you genuinely thought was true is the same as slander and fraud and things like that that are obvious violations of the Ninth Commandment. What I am saying is that we need to be a lot more careful with the share button online and with the share mechanism God designed in our bodies that He's set behind two rows of sharp teeth. Before we share things as fact, we better be pretty sure, pretty confident that the information we're passing on deserves our stamp of approval as accurate, because we're becoming a witness of its accuracy. And the trust, the credibility that other people have with us will be affected. So we need to put our best effort into ensuring the accuracy of the information we share with others. Whether that's information about people we know, events that took place, or whether it's something happening on the world scene or in the news. We have to consider the source of our information, what may be the agenda behind it, and what God would expect us to do with what we learn. We have to recognize our human limitations in knowing for sure what is true with many of the modern hot-button topics. Realize that we can't be experts on everything. And we have to choose our words carefully so that we don't fall into the pattern of just parroting what we've heard others say is true. A couple things we can do to try to guard against this half-truth, misinformation. One thing is at least provide a source for things we pass on or a caveat. You know what? I heard this recently on fill in the blank, whatever the source is. Or I'm not sure if this explanation is 100% accurate, but I thought it was interesting. I heard it from fill in the blank. Now, if that information proves to be false, the trust people have of you isn't on the line. Your credibility isn't on the line. They understand that you really thought this was true when you said it, right? Making this distinction can help keep that trust and that unity intact. Another thing we can do is simply check before we share. Just because you read it on the internet doesn't make it so. Check our sources for credibility. Know if what was presented claims to be a straight news source or if it's considered an opinion piece. There are differences. Whether it's in written media or whether it's in TV programs, news stations, etc. Some of them claim to be straight news sources. We're going to give you the facts, let you come to your own conclusions. Others are openly supporting a specific side of the political aisle or a specific agenda. We should know where our sources lie. And as I said before, try to get a balanced diet of information. Listen to other sides of the argument. And recognize, again, our personal limitations at understanding all of this and knowing whether something is completely accurate or not. Let's go to Psalm 141. Psalm 141, we'll read verses 3 and 4. Psalm 141, verse 3, we got to speed it up. I say that to you like you're the one slowing things down. It's not true. Psalm 141, I'm sorry, that's a half truth. Psalm 141, verse 3. Set a guard, O Lord, over my mouth. Keep watch over the door of my lips. Do not incline my heart to any evil thing, to practice wicked works with men who work iniquity, and do not let me eat of their delicacies. This is an important passage for us to consider when it comes to misinformation. David basically says here, help me watch what I say and not get caught up in wrong things, in speaking wrong things. Help me not get caught up in wicked works. Become partakers with these practicers of iniquity. We don't want to be parts or partners with those who are involved in falsehood. Do we trust the source of information enough to put our own trust on the line when we pass information on to others? Something to think about. We need to ask God to guard our lips and keep watch over the door of our mouths as David did here. Let's move on. We'll just briefly cover these last two. One more outright lie, one more half-truth. Outright lie number 4, little white lies. Little white lies. I'll read you another section from the Life, Hope, and Truth blog on enemies of honesty. Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines a white lie as a lie about a small or unimportant matter that someone tells to avoid hurting another person. It's just a little lie. For the protection of somebody else. But it's an outright lie. You know it's false. Some examples. Oh, honey, of course Santa is real. Or, yeah, that new Patrick Mahomes-style haircut looks great on you. Certainly it doesn't look like a squirrel climbed inside your helmet to hibernate and its tail couldn't quite fit. Or one from Eddie Foster's blog that I found humorous. Of course those oddly colored skin-tight pants don't make you look fat, darling. People think these types of lies are okay, even necessary, some would say, because they're for a good purpose, quote-unquote, such as trying not to hurt someone's feelings or trying not to steal a kid's joy. But what's God's perspective? LHT article, God Cannot Lie, Why Do People Lie? Says, of these white lies. But are they okay? More importantly, does God think white lies are okay? He doesn't make a distinction in the pages of the Bible. He does not say, don't lie unless the truth would hurt someone's feelings. And in parentheses, it says here in this article, however, he does tell us that there's a time to keep silence and a time to speak in Ecclesiastes 3, verse 7. It goes on to say, white lies might come with better intentions than other lies, but they're still products of dishonesty. God hates dishonesty. He wants us to hate it too. White lies are not the exception to the rule. Lies are lies, regardless of our intentions when we tell them. And if we go back and consider again the effect of lying, trust is affected, even with white lies. When a child learns that their parents lied to them about Santa Claus, how much are they going to trust their parents about what they're teaching them about Jesus Christ? When a spouse learns that we really hated that dress we said looked fine, how deeply are they going to trust and believe our genuine compliments? Right? I like the distinction that's made in that article about there being a time for everything. A time for silence and a time to speak. No, we don't have to go about with just honesty pouring forth out of our mouths, whether it's offensive or not. We need tact and wisdom as well. But we have to remember that not everything thought needs to be expressed. I know that's something that is a challenge to teach when you have young children. You may have some embarrassing stories of walking through the grocery store when things noticed are expressed before you can even get a hand over the mouth. But if we're honest with ourselves, that's not a guaranteed part of our development that changes, like growing taller. Even adults can struggle at times with what needs to actually be said and what would be better left inside. But whatever we do express, not everything needs to be expressed that's thought, but what we do express needs to be trustworthy. And if we're involved in the practice of little white lies, thinking they're not a big deal, then we're not trustworthy people in God's sight. And our trust with others will be affected. You can jot down Ephesians 4, verse 15, where we're told that we're to learn to speak the truth in love. That relates to that tact and wisdom that's involved in being honest with others. We should be learning to speak the truth in love. That's part of growing to become like Jesus Christ. Go read that verse. That's what it tells us. It's part of growing up to be like him, speaking the truth in love. Allowing for dishonesty when we find it convenient or easier on us is not part of growing up to be like him. So last one, half-truth number 4, inference. Inference. Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines inference as a conclusion or opinion that is formed because of known facts or evidence. An opinion or conclusion that's formed because of known facts or evidence. So the act of passing from one proposition or statement or judgment considered as true to another whose truth is just believed to be true. We got this set of facts. We came to this conclusion, this inference we drew from the conversation. There's a difference there. The facts themselves, our inference is the conclusion that we gain based on the facts. The Biblical Illustrator commentary on Exodus 20, verse 16, where the ninth commandment is recorded for us, the Biblical Illustrator covers many ways that could be mentioned in which we may avoid bearing false witness against our neighbor. It lists three. It says, one, we should try to form a true and just judgment of other people before we say anything against them. Drop down to number 3, which says we have no right to spread an injurious report merely because somebody brought it to us. That harkens back to not everything thought needs to be said. There's a time for silence. But number 2, the second way they point out that we can avoid bearing false witness, says we have no right to give our mere inferences from what we know about the conduct and principles of others as though they were facts. And reading that is why I included this as half-truth number 4, inference. Misrepresenting the facts by including our own interpretation of them as fact. When we pass on the conclusions that we've made as if they themselves are a fact, that could become a false witness, even if unintentionally. It's easy to do. It takes a lot of focus and determination not to do that, because it's just natural for us as we're receiving information, we're trying to connect it with other things we know and believe. We're processing information. We're connecting it with what else we have stored in our mind. We're drawing conclusions. And it can be really hard then when we pass information on to other people to just pass on the facts we heard without our inference and conclusions along with them as if they are dogmatic fact. Exactly what happened. The classic game of telephone is a great illustration of how the accuracy of information can be diminished the more it's shared, the more it's interpreted. You probably know the game. People sitting in a line or in a circle, someone starts out with a statement, a sentence, and they speak it, whisper it into one person's ear. That person hears it, they turn and they whisper it into the next person's ear. As you go around the circle or down the line, usually what the last person at the end of the line says out loud and reveals is not exactly the message that started at the beginning, right? Because it's been interpreted over and over again and changed ever so slightly. You know, how many of us have heard a story relayed about someone else only to talk to that person later and say, oh, I heard about whatever it is, fill in the blank, and have them look at us with a quizzical look and say, that's not what happened. And then we're kind of taken aback and we think, oh, well, so-and-so told me. And the person says, no, that's not exactly what happened. Inference is involved. Conclusions, opinions were passed on instead of just the straight facts. And sometimes that can lead to someone being a false witness. Even though it's lacking that intent to deceive, they still fill the role of passing on inaccurate information. And usually that can be cleared up. Other times there's some annoyance involved there. There's a lingering distrust because, okay, I don't want to tell this person anything anymore. They're going to pass on the info inaccurately. Well, I don't know if I can believe what this person tells me happened because last time I ended up looking stupid when I talked to the person about it and they said, no, that's not what happened at all. So inference again, something we need to be careful about in terms of the kind of witnesses we are being. It's a form of false witness that is a half-truth without necessarily any ill will or intent to deceive, but one regardless that we should be on guard against because it can happen so easily. We want to be people who preserve truth, those who have a reputation of accuracy and integrity and purity in our speech. And when we are, that leads to a greater trust that others have of us and to a greater trust with God as we show him how important truth is to us, that we want to be people who deal truthfully that he can delight in. So, brethren, there are many forms of false witness. We've covered a variety of them today. Many that we can get involved in. Some are pretty clear and blatant, others much more subtle. But Satan will promote them wherever they're most effective. Wherever he can get us involved in practicing a lie. With the exception of a couple of these examples today, the majority of them involve an intent to deceive. Sometimes that's through outright blatant lies, other times that intent to deceive is still present in the presentation of half-truths. But regardless of the reasoning behind any form of false witness, all of them, willful or not, diminish trust and the unity that we can therefore enjoy. So let's guard against these forms of false witness by upholding the value of truth and honesty, doing our part to ensure that we communicate to others what is accurate, reliable, and complete. In doing so, we'll be people that they can trust, and we'll become people that God can delight in.